The Comic Source presents the Top Cow Chronology Project. All right, welcome to the very first episode of The Comic Source presents the Top Cow Chronology Project. I'm one of the hosts, Jace, here with my co-host, Manny.
Hello.
So, just to give a brief history on Top Cow, Mark Silvestri was one of the founders of Image Comics in 1992. When he went over to Image, he formed his own studio, and he called that studio Top Cow. And his creator-owned book that he started there first was called Cyberforce. And he went ahead and formed his own studio, and he was recruiting talent, artists, and writers to work for Top Cow. And he had some success and published a few other books, codenamed Strike Force, and some other books such as that. Then in 95, he started a book called Witchblade. Now, Witchblade was a huge success for him, and he briefly took his studio, Top Cow, and left Image Comics in 1996 due to some differences with one of the other founders. So at that point, his studio went from being just Top Cow Studio to Top Cow Productions. And then the person he was having problems with left, and he came back under the Image umbrella toward the end of 1996. And at that point, Top Cow Productions, his studio was kind of moving away so much from the superhero to more of the fantasy realm with, as I said, the success of Witchblade and also kind of the sister book to Witchblade, which was The Darkness. So I've always been a big fan of Mark Silvestri, and I've always wanted to read Witchblade. And in fact, I have a giant Witchblade Compendium Volume 1 on my bookshelf that I've never actually read. So, for that reason, what is the Top Cow Chronology Project? Manny also has had a desire to read Witchblade. As I said, we're both fans of Top Cow and Matt Hawkins and the books they put out. So what we've decided to do is to read the entire chronology in order of the Top Cow universe and then talk to you guys about what we think about the issues as we read them. So I found online, actually on the Comic Vine website, there's a user there, goes by the name of Condor. That's K-O-N-D-O-R-R. And I want to make sure he gets credit because he spent many, many hours, I'm sure, compiling a chronology of Top Cow universe as far as not necessarily a publishing timeline, but a reading timeline. So what we're going to do is we're going to start by first reading the issues that are contained in Witchblade Volume 1 trade paperback. So that's Witchblade number 1 through 8. And we're just going to do that to kind of give us a feeling of what Witchblade is and kind of get our feet wet. And then we're going to go back and using Condor's timeline as a resource, we're going to read each issue in order and then talk about how we feel about those issues. So if you're interested in Top Cow and you found our podcast that way, or if you're just interested in learning about a new universe, these are just going to be little short episodes. I would think probably around 20 minutes to cover each issue as we go along. And I'm not quite sure how often we'll release episodes, hopefully two or three times a week to start. And if we ever want to get through this thing, maybe if we have enough demand, we may go to maybe four or five times a week. So we'll see. So who are we? Who are your hosts here for this podcast? How did we get started in comics? So Manny, give the folks here a little bit of a rundown on your history with comics.
Well, my history with comics just starts from when I was young. Growing up with Batman, the animated series, The Amazing Spider-Man, X-Men, you know, all those shows that, you know, leave an impression on you as a kid. But then as you get older, you mature a little bit more, and then you know, part of that kid stays with you, though. And I think the comic that really did it for me was when I first was able to read The Killing Joke. That just really showed me, you know, a different level of, you know, what can go on in a comic book, and that really got me started in, but it wasn't until just recently, a couple years ago, when we started really interacting at our workplace, that I really got a sense of how comics worked, writers I should be taking a look at, you know, some of my favorite heroes, obviously Batman and others. But then, you know, stumbling up, you know, on Top Cow. My first Top Cow I read was Think Tank. And that just blew my mind. And that, you know, led to me reading other things. Rise of the Magi. They released American Legends a couple months ago, which was really cool. Giving you a little bit of history. So, and it's all, and yeah, that's just what it is. It's an escape from, you know, the everyday, because a lot of times you wouldn't want to live in those worlds, but, you know, it's really cool to read, and that's really how it went for me.
Yeah, Top Cow's a really great publisher, and I feel like maybe they don't get the recognition they deserve, so hopefully by us doing this podcast, we can familiarize some of you with Top Cow and their history, where they've come from, where they're going, and maybe you'll give some of their books a chance. So as for me, I've been reading comics for... oh, not to date myself, but about 33 years now or so. Started when I was very young. I read voraciously when I was young, and, you know, the little corner store by my grandparents' house had a spinner rack, and I used to just go in there, and you know, my attention was just drawn to the amazing covers from back then, and since I love to read, I just used to pick up an issue or two here or there, and it just kind of grew from there, and I've pretty much been collecting comics ever since. Taking a few short breaks here or there when, you know, real life reared its ugly head, but for the most part, I've been a lifelong comic book fan. So, and I have my own channel on YouTube, The Comic Source. Maybe some of you listening are familiar with that. And now we've decided to start this podcast up so we can learn about Top Cow, learn about their history. Just to give a little background on Witchblade, it was created by the Top Cow founder, Mark Silvestri, along with another Top Cow editor at the time, David Wall. The writers were Brian Haberlin and Christina Z, and the art in the early going was handled by Michael Turner, who unfortunately passed away from cancer a few years ago, but is my all-time favorite comic book artist ever, which is another reason that I always had wanted to read Witchblade, just hadn't gotten around to it. Then was a huge fan of his series Fathom, which he started at Top Cow and then moved over to his own company, Aspen. And in fact, such a big fan that my daughter's name is Aspen. So there you go. Okay, so Witchblade has pretty much been published ever since it started in 1995 up to the present day, and we're going to give our thoughts on Witchblade number one right now. Okay, so Witchblade number one, as I said, published in 1995. Let me just get a quick rundown here of the creative team. The co-plot is David Wall, Brian Haberlin, and Michael Turner. The scripting was David Wall with Christina Z, and the inks were by D-Tron, colors by J.D. Smith and Nathan Cabrera. So let's get your overall first impressions, Manny. What do you think?
Well, I see it as an original story. That's for sure. I can't really get any similarities from anything else I've read. I know we had our doubts about, you know, what is this book going to be like, and it turned out to be a whole lot of good. Yeah. And the artwork's amazing. I'll tell you that. There's a lot of detail in here. Some of it, I mean, the chandeliers in the first few pages, you know, it's unnecessary, but I'm glad we have it. And then we get our first look at, I'm gonna guess, who's the villain of this whole plot, and you know, the first page, I'm gonna Kenneth Irons, who I will describe as evil Bruce Wayne. That's what he comes to me as.
So your first impression is it's good.
Yeah, definitely good.
Well, my first impressions, it seems very much of its time, and by that I mean you know, the comics of the 90s, the excess, the dark and gritty and brooding. I have to say, I'm a little disappointed. I don't know that I necessarily had high expectations, but I don't know. I don't know that I could quite put my finger on it. For sure, the art is amazing, but I knew the art was going to be amazing because it's Michael Turner, so I knew it was going to be great going in. I think maybe just the dialogue maybe just seems a little cheesy to me. You know what? Maybe it just seems like because I lived through the comics of the 90s, it wasn't necessarily a time of the greatest quality of comics. So maybe it just seems like to me it's trying a little too hard to be that dark and gritty. And so maybe it's just the perspective I bring to it that has me wondering. But I will agree with you. It's definitely an original idea. I definitely, you know, had I picked this up and read it at the time, I'm sure I would have liked it then, and I probably would have definitely kept reading. You know, I would have picked up issue 2. So with issue 2, it may improve.
Yeah, well, yeah,
I have to say, yeah, I'm a little disappointed, but hopeful.
Yeah, you're right. Our point of views are probably a little bit different because you said this was what, 96?
95.
95? I think I was in kindergarten in 95. So I didn't do too much comic book reading then. And I definitely know my parents would not be okay with me reading this at that age.
Yeah, and I do have to say that it was a pretty big hit at the time. It was everybody was reading Witchblade, just about. So, I mean, I bought the first trade paperback back then, even though I never got around to reading it. So, just to give a quick synopsis of the story, so we meet the main character here, Sarah Pazzini, who apparently is a cop in New York City, and as kind of an introduction to her, we learn that a friend of hers has been killed by a drug dealer. She takes it upon herself to kind of set the drug dealer up for a sting, unbeknownst to her precinct captain. And so we have right away some action right there as she kind of single-handedly takes on this room of drug dealers. Again, the art by Michael Turner is spectacular, very dynamic, very kinetic, interesting poses, of course, scantily clad women, muscular male anatomy. The detail, as Manny said, spectacular facial expressions, detail in the hair. Storytelling from panel to panel, all of it is really good. It's not quite as refined as Turner would come to be later, I see, you know, that being that I'm very familiar with him. This is a little blockier, so maybe he hasn't quite gotten to the place where he will get to as far as detail and cleanliness of rendering. But still, very enjoyable art. And we're also introduced to Sarah's partner, Michael Yee, her captain in her precinct, Lieutenant Joe Siri, who she claims is kind of the closest thing she has to family. So she kind of gets read the riot act for going out on her own with her partner to set up the sting for this guy who killed a friend of hers. Roughs up her CI, criminal informant, who kind of helped her nail that drug dealer to find out why he was trying to make such a big play, and finds out that the guy was trying to get money to attend this, I don't know, what would you say? I thought it was going to be a poker game.
Well, I thought it was more like a Mortal Kombat type tournament where they were going to fight for the right to wield the glove, because I mean they mention a winner a bunch of times, and, you know, a tournament says that somebody's going up against each other, and it turned out to be a little bit different. It was just kind of almost like a, what would you say, an Excalibur thing?
Yeah, yeah. So the main villain of the piece, as Manny said, Irons, apparently, an evil version of Bruce Wayne, Kenneth Irons, has this artifact, which is a glove, basically, and supposedly it's very powerful. We don't really know what it can do at this point. So apparently these ne'er-do-wells here paid big amounts of money to come and stick their hand into this gauntlet to see if they could possess it, if they could be the rightful wielder. Apparently, Irons at one point tried to wield it and was rebuffed with extreme prejudice. And he can't wield it himself. He cannot possess the Witchblade himself. So apparently his plan is to possess the rightful wielder of it. If he can't possess the Witchblade itself, he'll possess the wearer of it. So Sarah sneaks in, and she's kind of watching these people take their turns going up and sticking their hand into the Witchblade to see if they can wield it. First guy goes up, sticks his hand in, and it looks like he pretty much has the upper half of his arm burned off. Before the next guy can take his turn, we see that Sarah's partner, Michael Yee, has been discovered, apparently also trying to sneak in. And they decide they're going to kill him, basically. So Sarah, being a good partner, rushes in to try to save him, kind of jumps in front of his body, and she's hit several times with some bullets. The Witchblade's knocked off its pedestal. Sarah, as she's mortally wounded, kind of reaches out instinctively, hoping for a gun, a knife, anything. What she finds is infinitely more miraculous than anything she could have ever expected. So the Witchblade kind of responds to her and bonds to her hand. And we see that she kind of fires some fire or some kind of a power bolt from the Witchblade. Pretty much takes out everybody in the theater. And it's the beginning are the last words of the issue. So I guess we'll see where it goes from there with issue two.
One thing I just wanted to cover is before we meet our main character, there was a little introduction to Kenneth Irons. They note that he's known as the Entrepreneur of the Year in Fortune magazine, but at the same time, he's also doing a whole lot of sketchy things in the background. Drug trafficking, prostitution, slavery, weapons. If he's involved in everything, I guess, you know, in the open market and in the black market. They do a really good job at showing, you know, his status, his grandiose status in his house. You see his chandeliers, his diamonds, statues, paintings, as he walks through, and he's kind of giving you a little overview of his obsession with the Witchblade and how he wishes that he can wield it, but at the same time, if he can't have it, whoever can, he'll have them. And it really looks like whatever this guy wants, he gets. And there's no exception to that. One question that does arise to me is, does this guy have one arm? Or how does he know?
Yeah.
He can't put it on?
Yeah, does he have like a fake arm? It doesn't really ever show.
Yeah, I just went through it again just to see if maybe they show both hands. I know he has at least one, but he does say that that he's felt the pain of it, but not sure what that means at this particular time.
Yeah, he definitely seems like a control freak, a guy who's not used to being told no. And he possesses, he owns the Witchblade. He's in control of it, but he can't wield it. So that must, for a guy like him with all this power, and here's something he can't control, he can't exert his dominance and his will over, it probably drives him crazy. So but I have a feeling that with Sarah revealed as the rightful wielder of the Witchblade. It doesn't seem to me like he's going to be able to control her.
Definitely not.
As much as he's going to try. She seems to be very much a very independent, extremely strong-willed, maybe to a fault, putting her... In fact, I think her captain or her lieutenant says something to her to that effect that, you know, she's going to get herself hurt just being a maverick and going out on her own and, you know, not looking out for herself, so...
Yeah, well, if you remember when she went in for that undercover bust, she got her partner hurt pretty bad, and that was by her own means. She pistol-whipped him, which is what got her in trouble at the precinct.
Yeah, I think, her partner was undercover, and the drug dealer had a pretty good idea that he was a cop, and so in order to test Sarah, I think they wanted to see, you know, her take him out so they'd know that she was... legitimately a criminal. So, all in all, like I said, not quite as good as I expected, and I think the reason for that being is just it's a little bit of its time. Tries a little too hard to be the kind of dark and gritty, and maybe takes itself a little too seriously.
Well, for me, it was just nice to have a book that has a lot of substance, you know. I can take my time in reading this, and you know, it gives me a whole lot of information. It's not just a bunch of splash pages with action. You know, it's really detailed and, you know, really lets you know what's going on.
Yep, that's true. It definitely has more dialogue than one of the books of today. So, all right, that's going to do it for our wrap-up of Witchblade number 1.
You can like us on Facebook. Just do a search for The Comic Source. And a lot of times Manny and I go to conventions, we'll post pictures on there, and you can just get some heads up of what we have coming up. You can also follow us on Twitter. That's twitter.com/thecomicsource. Or drop us an email, thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com. And of course, like I mentioned earlier, we have our website, thecomicsourceblog.com. You can go there for episodes. You can watch my YouTube show there or check out Manny's blog. So check it out, and we'll see you next time
for Witchblade issue 2.